For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show usually recorded from the RNIB Talking Book Studios in London. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today I'm talking to you from my kitchen table, just to get a change of scene. And Robert?
I'm still in the bedroom. But coming up on today's show, we've got more Cabin Fever fables, this time with Chris Dolan.
Award-winning novelist Joanna Briscoe introduces us to her new novel, The Seduction.
And we've got a very special Books of Your Life from none other than John le Carré.
That's all coming up in today's Read On.
So how's the cupboard today then? Oh no, you're at your kitchen table.
Kitchen table is a lot more welcoming than the cupboard. It's got more headroom.
Just for a change of scene then.
Just for a change of scene and to be closer to the coffee. Are you still wearing your onesie or have you changed into your pyjamas?
It's too warm for all that.
I'm sorry, this is radio.
So coming up in today's show, we'll actually have two books of your life. First up, Red, you spoke to Joanna Briscoe.
I did indeed. Joanna Briscoe is the best-selling author of five novels and a string of short stories. Her best-known book, Sleep With Me, was dramatised by ITV and showcased her knack for exploring the stickier side of the human psyche. Her latest novel, The Seduction, is a similarly tense psychological tale and is due to be published in June. Here she is to give us a sneak preview and to talk about her life as an author. Joanna, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about The Seduction.
Yeah. Do you know what? I haven't spoken about it at all. This is the very first time. So it feels exciting you just saying the title. Okay, so The Seduction. It's about a woman who's in trouble. She's an artist. She lives in North London. She lives right by the canal between Camden and King's Cross. So there's loads of development going on either side, and it's very much about that place. It's a kind of natty little run where not much has gone on and it's still a bit damp and faintly sinister, possibly, where she lives with her husband and her one daughter. And the daughter starts being absent quite a lot and really very hostile towards Beth, the protagonist, and we don't know why. Beth was also left by her mother in childhood, so we get some flashbacks to that. So Beth goes to a therapist who starts to help her with all her problems. And the question that the publishers are asking is, what if the person who is meant to be the solution becomes the most dangerous problem of all? So I might have to leave readers to guess what that's about. I don't want to actually spell it out, but the psychologist is not all that she seems, and where there's meant to be help, there is great trouble.
Oh, it sounds like great, sinister Joanna Briscoe territory that I associate with you from Sleep With Me and Touched. You love that sense of foreboding and unstoppable forces, don't you?
I think so. You know, it's only after writing quite a lot that you start realising your own themes and obsessions, and mine are becoming very clear to me now. This is my sixth novel, and yes, I think you're right, but it's odd. You're just not conscious necessarily as the writer of these works for some time, but yeah, mine are becoming apparent.
I think when we were all watching Sleep With Me and Sylvie, the seemingly innocent character, first appears in the couple's life, it was really quite a groundbreaking plot twist for somebody to inveigle their way in like that. But it's certainly a plot that people like me who like twisting psychological thrillers can't get enough of.
Yeah, it's interesting because that was actually published in 2005. And my agent said, this is a literary erotic psychological thriller. And I said, what's a psychological thriller? Can you imagine saying what's a psychological thriller now? So it was kind of ahead of its time, but at the same time, I really didn't realise what I was writing. I'd never knowingly read a thriller. It's just that my kind of accessible literary style has a thrillerish element to it, it seems. So there were lots of plot twists in that one, yeah. And that lent it to televisation quite easily.
And you love tension in relationships. I'm always struck how your characters are always slightly on edge with each other, even at their best times. There's always a little bit of grit there.
Hey, interviewer, you've done your homework well here. You seem to know my novels better than I do. I think you're completely right.
I wonder if that fed into the Hammer Horror imprint coming to you and asking you to write the book that became Touched. Did that feel natural for you?
It did, and I was really surprised that the Hammer imprint, which was part of Arrow Random House, that they asked me, because I thought, why me? Why do they want me to write something slightly supernatural? But I took the challenge. It was at a good time, and it was short. It was only around 44,000 words. It made me realise there is something tense and quite gothic in my fiction, and I like definitely having attention in terms of relationships, but I think it's also about atmosphere and place. And in that one, it was a very sunny, happy-looking, picture postcard pretty village where all this darkness was going on. And I wanted to do that. I didn't want to have the normal haunted scenario. I wanted it to be ostensibly perfect. And that was fun playing with that. And then there's a very dark atmosphere in the house.
Yes, the lingering damp in the dark corners, which I think any of us who've grown up in an old house know all too well. And, well, it is a living thing. It can feel like something trying to take over your life.
It can. You know, that was because my bath in my house here in London, it had had a leak, and I would lie in bed and watch this stain spreading on the ceiling. A bit like Tess of the D'Urbervilles, but less sinister there. And I would get a bit obsessed with it in horror. I'd look at it thinking, oh no, look at that. It's horrible. And it kind of changed colour. And then that fed into my novel. So that was a real life thing. It was just a leaking bath.
And by the sounds of it, the seduction has a bit of damp in it as well. You were saying that the area that's being redeveloped has damp problems too.
Yes, you're right. What is this about damp? It's not so much the house has damp problems, but she does refer to that area being the one neglected bit between all this gentrification, this development, where you can actually see rats coming up from the canal in that place. And there are lots of overhanging trees, and the towpath is quite surprisingly rough and overgrown. And I like that atmosphere. There is this real little patch like that on the Regent's Canal in Camden Town. And I used to go along and look at it. And then I invented where the house was, but it was along there.
Well, I know as a writer, you like to get out and explore the locations that you write about and observe people as they go past and in conversation. You must be finding the current COVID-19 lockdown pretty unbearable, aren't you?
Do you know what? It's the opposite. It's strange. I'm living in this bubble. I've got pretty good circumstances, as in it's horrendous out there. It's tragic. It's awful. But I'm counting my blessings for the moment. I'm well. My son is home from university, so that's nice because that means I can see him more. And as a writer, I can actually just do what I do, which is I'm sitting here and I'm writing the next novel. And there are fewer distractions. And with the amazing sunny weather we've had, I have got a garden. I think if you haven't got a garden, it must be really difficult. And I have, and I appreciate that. And so I'm finding it at the moment, personally, pretty easy, actually. I can just use my imagination. But that's not to say I'm not aware of what's out there. And who knows, we may all get ill. I'm just very well at the moment, but you know, it's hell out there.
Absolutely. And London does seem an incredibly eerie place to live because there are so few people on the streets. And yet also knowing that, well, rather like damp blooming in the corner, nature will always find its way through. I never knew we had so many birds in London.
No, that's an incredible aspect of it. You can hear the birds. And I live on a very, very trafficy street. It's a real rat run. And yet, for the first time, I can hear the birds out there. And I wake up to the sound of birds now, which is very odd. And then on Hampstead Heath, of course, it's like being in the countryside completely. Mm. You're barely aware of the city. There are just lots of joggers that you have to get out of the way.
Can you imagine ever writing a book set during this health crisis?
I was thinking about this. I was thinking, as writers, we should all be writing notes about what this is actually like. And I haven't, of course. No, you know what I think? I think it will just be incorporated in much future fiction. I don't think we're going to want to read loads of post-apocalyptic novels necessarily, but I think it will be like the war. It will just be mentioned, or it'll be a backdrop. It'll be inevitably there now in decades or centuries worth of fiction. So I'm not personally driven to write about it. I don't think it's my kind of territory, but you can't ignore it.
No, I think you're right. And I think certainly it will become a question for, well, my teenage children and your son, you know, what did you do during the coronavirus crisis without necessarily it being something that forges their character?
Absolutely, because it has a huge impact on them. They're young. I mean, my daughter's in her first year of A-levels, so suddenly she's not at school. What do they all do? And I do see lots of teenagers outside who are not social distancing. You can understand how they feel immortal, but also I really feel for the ones who've got A-levels now. It's very, very difficult.
Now, by the time you were your daughter's age, I believe you'd submitted two manuscripts to publishers. You always knew you wanted to be a writer, didn't you?
I knew from age 15 for certain that I wanted to be a writer. Before that, I'd gone through various show-off professions in my head, like a show jumper, a ballet dancer, an artist. It was always exciting professions. But I had always written during that time. And then I knew for certain by 15, yeah. And I had a very good English teacher, and I just thought, I have to do this. But I did leave school a rejected novelist. As in, I didn't know about literary agents, and I was living in Devon, and I just sent two full-length children's manuscripts off to publishers. And it was very dispiriting getting all those rejections. I did get a few nice letters in with the standard rejections, but they still rejected me.
In some ways, though, it's a rite of passage for any author to have a drawer full of rejections, isn't it?
It is. It's just I was a bit precocious. It was a bit early to have that level of rejection. I'd actually started a third one by the time I left school. And then I went off to study English and I lost my confidence for a while, because if you're studying the canon, you think, who am I to do this? And also because I've been rejected so early. But I did pick myself up again and wrote again. It just took quite a while because I was having to earn a living as well, of course.
Did you keep those manuscripts? Are they tucked away somewhere?
Oh, yes, I certainly do. And in fact, the supposedly adult one, groups of friends and I used to take it out so that we could just hoot with laughter. We'd all quote bits at each other because it is so pretentious, so over the top. And it stops at the sex bit, because that's where the whole manuscript stops, because I didn't know what I was describing. And there's literally a bit with the protagonist in her nightie and a cardigan sitting in a bed, and that's where it stops. And we all just absolutely roar with laughter when we read it. It's seriously bad. Whereas I think one of the children's novels is quite good. I still quite like it. The first one was just derivative. The second one, I still believe in that story, actually. Maybe I should find it again.
Well, I shall look forward to that seeing the light of day. Now, as we said at the beginning of the interview, The Seduction should be published in time for the summer holidays. And fingers crossed, there will be an audiobook version. Are you somebody who reads your books as audiobooks, or are you still a lover of print?
I've got to admit, I am still a lover of print. I listen to the odd audiobook. I read my own prose aloud sometimes to hear what it sounds like, because it's very different. I just enjoyed the BBC Middlemarch, listening to that on my phone as I fall asleep. But No, I've had my novel, You, was an audiobook. I hope The Seduction will be. I tend to send my novels to my Kindle, and then I can have the print bigger, and it looks different on a Kindle. So I tend to read them that way when I'm reading them back to myself.
Yes, and of course, one thing listeners might not know is that you have yourself had pretty bad problems with your eyes over the past few years.
I have. Mercifully, I'm pretty much okay now. I've lost my fine central focus, and I think my colour perception is slightly affected, and I have a slight wobble on straight lines, but the brain compensates. It's amazing. Quite early, actually, in my mid-40s, I had macular traction, and it made a hole in the macula, so in the centre of the retina, and I had no functioning sight in the eye. It was terrifying. And I ran to the doctor thinking maybe it's a brain tumour, and they said, go to Moorfields. And so, yeah, I had very good surgery. There were quite a few problems with inflammation afterwards. And then there's only a 10% chance of it happening in the other eye, but it did. So I've had 5 eye operations altogether, but that includes cataract surgery because it caused cataracts as they anticipated. But after all that, because obviously if you have cataract surgery, it can correct your myopia. This is the first time in my life I don't have to wear glasses or lenses for distance, which is astonishing.
That's quite a journey from practically losing your sight to actually ending up not having to be a glasses wearer.
It's incredible. It was in one of my eyes. There was no functioning sight. You know, I couldn't see anything. It was so distorted out of one eye. The other wasn't so bad. We knew what was happening. It was happening gradually. But yes, after all this surgery, it's amazing. I don't have to have glasses for short sight. And I've got pretty good sight. So I do really thank Moorfields. I've had a lot of care at Moorfields Eye Hospital.
Well, it's always good to meet another season ticket holder for Moorfields. They do a fantastic job.
We're really lucky to have that hospital. We really are. It's incredible. And people travel from around the world to it. And I'm just one tube ride from it. So I fully appreciate it.
I'm glad you have got your sight back. And I'm delighted that there's going to be a new Joanna Briscoe novel to read over the summer. As I say, it's called The Seduction. And Joanna Briscoe, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks again to Joanna Briscoe. For a list of her books that are in the RNIB library, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. And Joanna will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
Actually, she won't be. At the end of today's show, we've got the Books of Your Life from John le Carré. Joanna Briscoe's Books of Your Life will be up after this.
Here at RNIB, we understand that these uncertain times may be causing additional worries for people with sight loss. Our teams are working hard to increase our support for blind and partially sighted people to ensure they get access to vital information and help. Our advisors are providing advice and support related to the current situation, connecting people to local support and linking people up with social groups meeting online and over the phone. If you or a loved one need help, then please call our helpline on 0303 123 9999. The helpline is open 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. on weekdays and 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. on Saturdays. The number again, 0303 123 9999. Or you can email helpline at rnib.org.uk.
RNIB. See differently.
Now it's back to Joanna Briscoe for the books of her life. Joanna, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, I was a huge reader as a child, but I was just immersed in those worlds and in love with the literature. But the novel that really made me want to write was Cider with Rosie. And luckily I read that at school. So that's a depiction of the author Laurie Lee's childhood in the Cotswolds in the early 20th century. It's extraordinarily vivid and lush, an amazing evocation of country life and family life. And I just loved it and read it and reread it and reread it. And that definitely influenced me in terms of being a writer.
I was set down from the carrier's cart at the age of 3, and there, with a sense of bewilderment and terror, my life in the village began. The June grass amongst which I stood was taller than I was, and I wept. I'd never been so close to grass before. It towered above me and all around me, each blade tattooed with tiger skins of sunlight. It was knife-edged, dark, and a wicked green, thick as a forest and alive with grasshoppers that chirped and chattered and leapt through the air like monkeys. I was lost and didn't know where to move. A tropic heat oozed up from the ground, rank with sharp odours of roots and nettles. Snow clouds of elder blossom banked in the sky, showering upon me the fumes and flakes of their sweet and giddy suffocation. High overhead ran frenzied larks, screaming as though the sky were tearing apart. For the first time in my life I was out of sight of humans. For the first time in my life I was alone in a world whose behavior I could neither predict nor fathom. A world of birds that squealed, of plants that stank, of insects that sprang about without warning. I was lost, and I didn't expect to be found again. I put back my head and howled, and the sun hit me smartly on the face like a bully.
Stephen Jack narrating Cider with Rosie by Laurie Lee, which is TB1241.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
One of the novels I reread most is Thomas Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles. I am also obsessed with that novel. Again, it's the countryside. In a way, I think we all want to be in the country at the moment. I certainly would quite like to escape London right now. Not going to happen. Tess of the D'Urbervilles, it's so beautiful. It's so beautifully written. It's so tragic. And I never stop admiring it. I reread it every few years.
On an evening in the latter part of May, a middle-aged man was walking homeward from Shaston to the village of Marlott in the adjoining Vale of Blackmore, or Blackmoor. The pair of legs that carried him were rickety, and there was a bias in his gait which inclined him somewhat to the left of a straight line. He occasionally gave a smart nod, as if in confirmation of some opinion, though he was not thinking of anything in particular. An empty egg basket was slung upon his arm. The nap of his hat was ruffled, a patch being quite worn away at its brim, where his thumb came in taking it off.
Tess of the D'Urbervilles by Thomas Hardy is also narrated by Stephen Jack, and it's TB1014.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I've read two novels recently that I'd like to share. One is Symposium by the brilliant Muriel Spark, which I've never read before. And one reviewer talked about its sinister elegance, which is certainly true. And it's a kind of society murder. There's an unlikely murderer and the setting is a dinner party and then we flash back. And the other novel is only just published. It's Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell, which is all about Shakespeare's only son and his mother, Anne Hathaway, and sisters. And so it looks at the other members of the Shakespeare family and their life. And it's tragic. It's very, very sad, and it's brilliantly done.
He was Lord Susie. His title was hereditary, so that when this was explained to busy people before their meeting him, they were inclined to say, "Yes, but what about him?" It is true that he had done nothing very much. He was approaching the dangerous age of 50, said to be the time of the male menopause. His two previous marriages and divorces had passed like the storms of old sea voyages. Helen, the present Lady Susie, was 22. She stood there, sleepy and leggy, with her hands up at her short dark hair, amazed. She had been married to Brian Susie nearly a year, during which she had frequently thought of flight. She had met her husband at the school play, where he had come to watch his daughter act in Death of a Salesman, the Dramatic Society's choice for that year. Helen was a schoolmate of Pearl, Lord Susie's only child, and from his second marriage. Pearl was now far away in Manhattan, operating a word processor at the United Nations, and had written about her honey of a job, which made Helen feel lonely and envious. Helen's own parents were divorced. She had missed her father most of all, and that, she said, was probably why she was attracted to older men and had finally fallen for Brian Susie.
Rosalind Shanks narrating Symposium by Muriel Spark, which is TB 8487.
Joanna Briscoe, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show, and I look forward to talking to you in the future.
Thank you.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews.
Saraband Books are an independent publisher in Scotland, and during this time of social distancing and self-isolation, they say that cabin fever is real. But Saraband don't want anyone to feel scared or alone, so they started a podcast, a place to share stories, spread calm and have a laugh.
Hello and welcome to Cabin Fever Fables. I'm Sarah Hunt from indie publisher Saraband, and this is episode 3. Each day we're challenging an author to read an extract from their book that has some sort of coronavirus link. Whether it's on loneliness, kindness, escapism, contagion, fear, hope, stockpiling, teaching technophobes to use video calling, keeping the kids occupied, or anything we can relate to in our strange new world. We're doing this to provide a short diversion from people's anxiety and loneliness if we possibly can. So we want to keep the tone positive, hopeful, funny even, or uplifting. Today is a first for this podcast in that our featured author, Chris Dolan, has drafted in help to narrate one of the voices in his forthcoming book. He'll do the introductions. It's also our first non-fiction. Chris has written about his cycling, busking and walking journeys through Spain from a long time ago and just recently. His book is called Everything Passes, Everything Remains. And of course, we hope the crisis passes quickly and we all remain.
Everything Passes and Everything Remains has a subtitle, Freewheeling Through Spain, Song and Memory, which gives you an idea of what it's all about. It's a particular cycling trip this time last year across Spain, but also 45 years of involvement with the country. Throughout the book, there are song lines, poems, memories, and some pen portraits of people that we thought about or met or whatever along the way. And here's one about a great heroine and a connection between the west of Scotland and Spain.
Governments will never save the people. They exist to exploit and destroy the people. There is but one force that can save the people, and that is the people themselves.
A young woman walks wide-eyed down the ramblas in the early morning. The sky's a lively, welcoming blue, the air balmy. She's been in Barcelona for only 12 hours. She has a notebook at the ready. She's small, quietly dressed, knows how to disappear into a crowd. The flower sellers are out in strength this morning, which surprises her given the situation. It could be just another day in an ordinary city anywhere. But this is the most exciting place to be in 1936, especially for Ethel MacDonald. War is sweeping over Spain, and although the Catalan capital is preparing for battle, there's an air of optimism, exhilaration. The city is in the throes of the most profound revolution of the 20th century. Workers run businesses by committee. The police force has been abolished. 2,000 years of sexual politics overturned. Anarchism, not anarchy, for the only time in its history, is the official state system. Ethel jots down a few notes, observations that will form the first of many dispatches that will grow in import and drama over the next 10 months.
Birds were singing in the trees and the sky was the most beautiful blue I've ever seen. Civilian soldiers, dressed in dungarees and little red and black Glengarry bonnets, smoking endless cigarettes, strolled casually in Las Ramblas, or chatted to the girl soldiers in the Plaza Catalunya. We had difficulty deciding which were young men and which were girls. They were dressed exactly alike, but as we drew nearer, we saw that all the girls had beautifully permed hair and were strikingly made up.
The first things Ethel would have sought out were the various military centres. The telephone exchange and Chamber of Commerce were held by the anarchists. The socialists and communists were uptown. In between, the poem the Trotskyist George Orwell was fighting with. But what was a girl from an impoverished background in Motherwell doing in Barcelona? Ethel MacDonald was to become, for a few short months, one of the world's most famous voices. She was perhaps the first example of an embedded reporter, sending dispatches back from the Spanish anarchist camp, but she made no pretense of impartiality. Ethel was a socialist, but with very little faith in the parliamentary system and none in authoritarian communism. She was utterly committed to anarchism and revolution, but those ideals were not comic book cliches. Her anarchism was in search of peace, reason, and liberty. 40 years of Franco's regime has all but wiped out the memory of the Spanish Revolution. The communists too would prefer that we forget all about the anarchists and their extraordinary achievements. On July the 9th, 1937, newspaper headlines announced that Ethel MacDonald had been arrested and jailed in Spain and would soon be tried. In an article smuggled out of Barcelona, she describes the scene of her arrest.
One night, at about 1 o'clock, there was a thunderous knocking at the door. Assault guards marched in and, without a word of explanation, ransacked every corner and every cupboard. They took me to the police station and left me there all night. They wanted me to sign some document, but I refused. The next morning, I was moved to the Hotel Falcon, which had become a prison for anarchist soldiers. They took me in a motor lorry that for all the world was like the tumbril of the French Revolution.
But it wasn't Franco who had imprisoned her and thousands of her friends. It was her erstwhile comrades, the communists. Beyond Barcelona, Ethel was dubbed the Scots Scarlet Pimpernel. Editors and readers demanded action, fearing the worst. The girl from Motherwell had been imprisoned by the very people she had gone to Spain to help and whose story she was still determined to tell to the wider world. MacDonald was part of a generation of dedicated people, mainly men, who left their families, jobs, security to fight for an ideal in a distant country. Ethel was different not just for being female. Her hopes for Spain were much more radical than the Republican governments or the communist-backed militias. Some might argue today, as they did then, that those hopes were too radical, unrealistic. But she was hardly alone. The vast majority of the Catalan people not only shared her vision, but had been carefully making it a reality for 2 years before Ethel's arrival. The men who came from Scotland, England, and almost every part of Europe and the United States fought alongside the Spanish people to halt the rise of fascism. The question was, and remains to this day, to replace it with what? Many international brigadistas were inspired by the communist ideal. But what was the point, Ethel and the Catalan people asked, in fighting one tyranny only to replace it with another? Finally out of Spain, having escaped Stalin's secret police, Ethel spoke to crowds in France, Holland, London, and finally on her return home in Glasgow. These speeches are a record of a fundamental ideal that refuses to die. The notion of a truly democratic and just society, free of coercion and oppression. Her story is also, of course, one of defeat. a personal loss and, more importantly, a national loss in Catalonia and Spain generally. Fascism won out. But what the Catalan people achieved in the mid-1930s is a potent reminder of the politically possible.
English-speaking workers, why are you sleeping while your Spanish brothers and sisters are being murdered? Where are your traditions? Speak! Act!
Thank you. And may I present, as the part of Ethel MacDonald, Moira Leven.
Hey.
Okay, so this little podcast we're doing for Sarah and Saravant. Mm-hmm. So we've got four questions. I'm going to just spring these on you.
Yeah. All right, okay. Hope they're not too difficult.
Yeah, they're very, very hard. Okay, so what are we reading to pass the time in lockdown?
Oh, funnily enough, I'm reading Sue Black's All That Remains about forensic anthropology. It's a bit ironic given everything that's happening just now, but...
Just you want to cheer
I'm
you up.
I'm enjoying it. Kind of enjoying it, yeah.
My plan is to read lots of Latin American and Spanish novels because I can't get going there and just to feel the heat of them.
Oh, that's a good idea. I quite fancy that myself.
I'll give you yours.
I'll fight you for them.
I'm not reading the Sue Black one. Not until after this is over. Okay, what are we cooking tonight from the store cupboard?
Well, tonight will be from the freezer, where there are numerous bags of food which has been frozen from various parties that have been had over the last few weeks. Only thing is, some of them are not labelled, so it could be meat chili or vegetarian chili. It'll be, well, it's a surprise. A lucky dip. Lucky dip.
That's exactly what it's like. I like it. You don't know until it's thawed out. I have no idea what that is. So that's brilliant. So another surprise tonight, and that should keep on going for a bit.
Yeah.
Okay, who would we choose to dine with tonight if we were not all self-isolating?
Oh, I think it'd have to be the kids to celebrate Daniel and Janie's engagement of 2 weeks ago that we haven't had a chance to celebrate.
And poor old Emma, our daughter, and Jared, our partner, are in quite a small flat in Aberdeen, so it'd be nice to have them around in a slightly bigger place.
Yeah.
Another thing about... perhaps because we read that, and because this time last year I was cycling around Spain... Just to be in a Spanish restaurant, just to be outside on a pavement saying hello to everybody instead of shunning everybody.
I'll trust you to want the impossible. That is that is definitely out.
And that leads us nicely on to the next thing, which is the most idiotic, infuriating, and this is not just about me, Moira, the most idiotic, infuriating, funny, or any other kind of advice we've got about Corona and the whole situation.
Well, there were the two guys who were seen standing outside a block of flats, both wearing masks. Might be a good idea, might not, I'm not sure.
They showed some responsibility.
Well, maybe. Mm. But they both took the masks off to share a joint. So,
not so great,
what can you say about that?
Did we see this for a minute? Daniel told us on the phone the other night about that girl, a 22-year-old girl who is very, very, very sick with COVID-19. She can barely breathe. She'll probably by today be on a ventilator. But trying to talk to her, Daniel was asking what happened, and she said she'd been out the night before in the pub. That's just a couple of nights ago. Was out in a pub with her friends. They told her immediately that you had to text everyone to say they have to self-isolate. But he said to her, "Didn't you know? I heard about the coronavirus?" And apparently she said, Yeah, I'd heard about it, but I really didn't think it was that much of a thing.
That's crazy. How crazy is that?
She does now.
Yeah.
So keep a safe distance, folks, everybody, yeah? Mm. And thanks to Sarah and Saravan for doing this, because it keeps us all talking and reading.
Great. Yeah, thanks, okay. Sarah.
Okay, so it's good night for me and it's good night for Ethel MacDonald.
Mm.
Goodbye. And if that sign-off didn't mean anything to you, ask an older person about the two Ronnies and get yourself straight to YouTube. Chris and Moira's son, Daniel, has a deadly serious message from the NHS frontline there. There is literally no point having any generational complacency or strife in this crisis. Young people are now dying too, so there's no place for finger pointing. We all have a responsibility to protect ourselves and our fellow world citizens right now. Stay home, be safe. As we just heard, people save themselves. Governments can only do so much. And on a lighter note, let's not even ask whether those two Darwin Award-winning stoners are boomers or kids. My colleague Aisling has signed up to give blood tomorrow. There's been a 15% drop in donations as a result of this crisis, but we still need to give blood. There's a BBC website story detailing how to volunteer for this if you're fit and healthy. We'll post links to that on Twitter. There's been quite a bit of mixed messaging from our own government and, of course, from across the pond during this crisis. Being in publishing, we are very aware of the power of language. It struck me how much better the women leaders have communicated, with direct, clear, no bullshit, and still caring language. Oh, for more leaders like Jacinda Ardern, Nicola Sturgeon, that is, the undubbed version, and Angela Merkel, otherwise known as Mutti. Quite a lot of the male leaders are using militaristic language about war and fighting, and metaphors for conflict. They're often flip-flopping instead of just delivering the message. I also enjoyed learning from Angela Merkel's statement that the German for squirreling away equates to the word hamstering. So now the pubs are closed, and we can only dream, like Chris and Moira, of dining at an outdoor Spanish cafe, or really anywhere, sociably. Bookshops are closing, including Waterstones and Blackwell's and many of the indies. But we'll keep on posting shout-outs to folk who can still deliver you a book. Back to our fantasy podcast world. It's starting to look like a bit of a party, if a weird one, with our dining guests and the random store cupboard menu. So far, we've got Chinese chicken from Graham, Lucky Dip freezer food from Chris and Moira, and chocolate with condensed milk on the menu. That one's from Olga Voitas. For guests, we've got Isabelle Huppert and Nick Cave, chosen by Graham, David Tennant with Olga, and a family dining group for Chris and Moira. In our new world, I think we need to be egalitarian and think these things through carefully, so I would vote that Chris and Moira's son Daniel goes to the head of the table and gets first choice of food. He needs to be fed and kept in tip-top shape for his NHS work, before we work out how to seat everyone else. We'll keep the reading list updated too. It's pretty eclectic so far. Coming soon on Cabin Fever Fables, we'll be featuring a MasterChef winner and someone with excellent home exercise tips, maybe even with some video. But that's all for today. Please support authors, publishers, bookshops, and others who feed our imagination and keep us informed and entertained. Tune in soon for episode 4, and contact us on Twitter at Saraband Books.
Thanks again to Sarah at Saraband Books and to Chris Dolan.
And we'll have more Cabin Fever Fables in future editions of Read On. Now, back, before Christmas, when the world was a different place, episode 150 featured John le Carré.
Yeah, I spent an hour and a half with him in the comfort of his sitting room. And if you want to hear the full interview, it's available as a podcast. Just search for Read On, the audiobook show, and find episode 150.
But as Red said, he spent an hour and a half with them, and our show is only an hour long. So we didn't have time for John le Carré's books of his life until now.
So, was there a book that you read as a young man that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
There were no books in my house. Nobody read to me until I got to my second prep school. And then I heard The Wind in the Willows and absolutely fell in love with all the characters. Very confused by the end. I didn't like meeting Pan and all that stuff. But I loved The Wind in the Willows, and that never left me. And the theme is decency, of course.
The mole had been working very hard all the morning, spring cleaning his little home. First with brooms, then with dusters, then on ladders and steps and chairs, with a brush and a pail of whitewash, till he had dust in his throat and eyes, and splashes of whitewash all over his black fur, and an aching back and weary arms. Spring was moving in the air above, and in the earth below, and around him, penetrating even his dark and lowly little house, with its spirit of divine discontent and longing. It was small wonder, then, that he suddenly flung down his brush on the floor, said, "Bother!" and "Oh, blow!" and also, "Hang spring cleaning!" and bolted out of the house without even waiting to put on his coat. Something up above was calling him imperiously, and he made for the steep little tunnel which answered, in his case, to the gravelled carriage drive owned by animals whose residences are nearer to the sun and air. So he scraped and scratched and scrabbled and scrooged, and then he scrooged again, and scrabbled and scratched and scraped, working busily with his little paws and muttering to himself, "Up we go! Up we go!" till at last, pop! His snout came out into the sunlight, and he found himself rolling in the warm grass of a great meadow. "This is fine," he said to himself. "This is better than whitewashing." Jumping off all his four legs at once, in the joy of living and the delight of spring, without his cleaning, he pursued his way across the meadow till he reached the hedge on the further side. "Hold up," said an elderly rabbit at the gap. "Sixpence for the privilege of passing by the private road." He was bowled over in an instant by the impatient and contemptuous mole, who trotted along the side of the hedge, chaffing the other rabbits as they peeped hurriedly from their holes to see what the row was about. "Onion sauce! Onion sauce!" he remarked jeeringly, and was gone before they could think of a thoroughly satisfactory reply.
The inimitable Richard Briers narrating The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham, which is TB 701 650.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I'm afraid it's P.G. Woodhouse. I mean, again, that is just a bottle I'd take down from the shelf. I can scarcely remember whether I've read. I've read them all. It doesn't much matter. I dip in and enter that kind of sublime world. Yes, so I mean, that's lighting the fire and sitting down for half an hour and reading. Otherwise, well, we talked about Conrad. And I would certainly just reread Conrad with absolute pleasure. Then my German soul takes me back to Schiller and Goethe. That's almost nostalgic for me because I immersed myself in that stuff at such a young age. When I went to Bern University and then afterwards at Oxford University, then I taught that stuff at Eton and haven't much visited it since. Take It Down Now is really a journey through my youth.
Into the face of the young man who sat on the terrace of the Hotel Magnifique at Cannes, there had crept a look of furtive shame. The shifty, hangdog look which announces that an Englishman is about to talk French. One of the things which Gertrude Butterwick had impressed upon Monty Bodkin when he left for this holiday on the Riviera was that he must be sure to practice his French. And Gertrude's word was law. So now, though he knew that it was going to make his nose tickle, he said,
Garçon.
Monsieur.
Garçon, est-ce que vous avez un spot de l'encre et une piste de papier, a note papier, vous savez, et une enveloppe et une plume?
Bien, monsieur. The strain was too great. Monty relapsed into his native tongue.
I want to write a letter, he said. And having, like all lovers, rather a tendency to share his romance with the world, he would probably have added,
to the sweetest girl on earth. Had not the waiter already bounded off like a retriever to return a few moments later with the fixings.
"V'là, sir. There you are, sir," said the waiter. He was engaged to a girl in Paris, who had told him that when on the Riviera, he must be sure to practice his English. Ink, pen, paper, envelope, and a little bit of blotting paper.
"Oh, merci," said Monty, well pleased at this efficiency. "Thanks. Right-ho."
"Right-ho, monsieur," said the waiter.
Mr. Verloc, going out in the morning, left his shop nominally in charge of his brother-in-law. It could be done because there was very little business at any time and practically none at all before the evening. Mr. Verloc cared but little about his ostensible business. And, moreover, his wife was in charge of his brother-in-law. The shop was small, and so was the house. It was one of those grimy brick houses which existed in large quantities before the era of reconstruction dawned upon London. The shop was a square box of a place, with the front glazed in small panes. In the daytime the door remained closed. In the evening it stood discreetly but suspiciously ajar. The window contained photographs of more or less undressed dancing girls, nondescript packages in wrappers like patent medicines, closed yellow paper envelopes, very flimsy and marked 2 and 6 in heavy black figures. A few numbers of ancient French comic publications hung across a string as if to dry. A dingy blue china bowl, a casket of blackwood, bottles of marking ink and rubber stamps. A few books with titles hinting at impropriety.
Bruce Montague reading The Luck of the Bodkins, which is TB4472, and Stephen Crossley narrating The Secret Agent by Joseph Conrad. And we'll have more about that book in a moment. A huge selection of books by P.G. Woodhouse is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, there's an extraordinary non-fiction book, which is a seriously researched biography of the secret agent Richard Salger, who operated in Tokyo for Stalin during the 39-45 war and before, and gave Stalin date, place, everything for the invasion of the Soviet Union by Hitler, and such a quantity of information that it absolutely changed the course of the war. For instance, whether the Japanese were interested in invading Manchuria, they weren't, and therefore Stalin could direct his troops towards what became Stalingrad. Those things, I think it's a wonderful book, a wonderful piece of history, easily read.
Richard Zorge was a bad man who became a great spy. Indeed, one of the greatest spies who ever lived. The espionage network that he built in pre-war Tokyo put him at just one degree of separation from the highest echelons of power in Germany, Japan, and the Soviet Union. Zorge's best friend, employer, and unwitting informant, Eugen Ott, German ambassador to Japan, spoke regularly to Hitler. Zorge's top Japanese agent, Hotsumi Ozaki, was a member of the cabinet's inner advisory council and regularly talked to Prime Minister Prince Konoy. And in Moscow, Zorge's immediate bosses were constant visitors to Stalin's Kremlin study. Zorge survived as an undetected Soviet spymaster for nearly 9 years in Tokyo, even as Japan was swept by hysterical spy mania and the police constantly hunted for the source of his regular, coded radio transmissions. And yet, he managed to steal the most closely kept military and political secrets of both Germany and Japan while hiding in plain sight.
An Impeccable Spy by Owen Matthews is available commercially in print, ebook, and audio, narrated by Mike Grady.
Well, John Le Carré, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading and for being a guest on Read On.
Thanks again. It was great fun.
Now, because we've got a minute or two left in today's show, now, I found Stephen Crossley narrating The Secret Agent by Joseph Conrad, but you found one by Robin Holmes, and it was TV number 569. So if we go by the number, it was the 569th book that entered the Talking Books library. I thought it might be interesting to listen to a couple of lines from each to compare and contrast.
These customers were either very young men who hung about the window for a time before slipping in suddenly, or men of a more mature age, but looking generally as if they were not in funds.
Some of that last kind had the collars of their overcoats turned right up to their moustaches, and traces of mud on the bottom of their nether garments, which had the appearance of being much worn and not very valuable. And the legs inside them did not, as a general rule, seem of much account either. With their hands plunged deep in the side pockets of their coats, they dodged in sideways, one shoulder first, as if afraid to start the bell going. The bell, hung on the door by means of a curved ribbon of steel, was difficult to circumvent. It was hopelessly cracked, but of an evening, at the slightest provocation, it clattered behind the customer with impudent virulence. It clattered.
So there you go, two versions of The Secret Agent. It just shows how much narration has come on through the years. No offence to Robin Holmes, he was a fantastic narrator, but he was one of the guys recording the wax, so had to go for 22 minutes without a mistake.
Well, I'm glad we don't have to do that. The miracles of digital... The miracles of digital recording, Robert.
Yep, and as this music fading up in the background means we'll soon be saying goodbye. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week.
But don't forget to tune in at the same time next week. And of course, we're always available as a podcast. Just search your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show.
And don't forget to leave a review. You can rate us 5 stars, please, and subscribe if you can.
You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at RedSale, which is REDSZELL, and Robert,
I'm at Talking_Books.
Farewell until next week. Take care, stay healthy, and don't forget to read on.